to harvest. The next year, while Gorbachev was in high school, the team won a coveted honor, the Medal of the Red Banner. Such an honor was the first step toward a life in the party. Many years later, when he was the regional party leader in Stavropol, Gorbachev would visit the farms in the region and stun his traveling party when old farming friends like the shepherd Vasily Rudenko would greet him with a bear hug and, "Hey, Misha, have you eaten?" With that, they would march into Rudenko's hut for a plate of jellied innards and a bowl of borscht. After the brief and unnerving driving tour of Privolnoya, we headed for the town of Krasnogvardaiskoye, or Red Guard. Gorbachev knew this stretch of road well. 4 decades before, he woke early in his parents' house, a two-room hut made of mud, manure, and straw, with pigs and chickens and an outhouse in the yard. The harvest was over. The village schools were opening. Gorbachev tucked a package of homegrown food under his arm, met up with his friend Dmitry Markov, and began the walk to Krasnogvardaiskoye's high school number 1. Gorbachev rented a bed in the house of an old retired couple there. Weekends he returned home to Privolnoya to work in the fields. The 2-story brick high school fast became the center of Gorbachev's universe. He was the classic small-town overachiever, the class president type who scored high marks, starred in the school plays, and won the heart of the best-looking girl in the school. For half a day, I buzzed around the town, talking to teachers, old friends, people on the street. There was, of course, something preposterous about the entire mission, something straight out of the old television series, This Is Your Life. Yekaterina Chaika, Gorbachev's old chemistry teacher, was one of several people to deliver twinkling remembrances and boilerplate as if on cue. "He is a man of his time," she said, "and there are countless factors of history that come into play. But if you want to understand him better as a man, it doesn't hurt to know where he came from. Like anyone, he has roots. And those roots are right here." Others, who probably did not know him at all, conjured visions of the ideal. "You know," one man told me, "I don't think Mikhail Sergeyevich even had that birthmark on his head when he was here." But there were others in town who had something to show me. The high school principal was Oleg Shredny, a man at least 15 years younger than Gorbachev. He seemed unfazed by the prospect of helping an uninvited foreigner find out more about the general secretary of the Communist Party. "You want to see Mikhail Sergeyevich's grades?" he said. "I think we have them here in the safe." Plump and graceful, Shredny darted across his office to the safe and brought out a musty Dickensian ledger. He opened to 1950. The year of Gorbachev's graduation. And there, in a formal hand and cloudy ink, was Gorbachev, Mikhail Sergeyevich, and a line of numbers. On a grade scale with 5 being the highest to 1 the lowest, Gorbachev had a nearly uninterrupted row of 5s. Algebra, Russian literature, trigonometry, history of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Constitution, astronomy, and so on. The one blemish was a 4 in German. Apparently, his class in Privolnoya refused to take German after the war, so he was a bit behind when he got here, Shredny said in a tone of churchly reverence. That is why he got the silver medal here, not the gold. Except for the portrait of Gorbachev on Shredny's office wall, the school had not paid much attention to honoring their native son. In the school's Hall of Fame, Gorbachev was listed as just one medal winner among many, a future general secretary next to Gennady Fateyev, the class poet. I have been to high schools in the United States where third-rate quarterbacks have been honored more grandly. Shredny had made sure there would be no personality cult in the halls of his school. In our day, there were lots of pictures of Stalin, of course. I remember one especially, a portrait of Stalin and Mao called The Great Friendship, said Yuri Sarikov, one of Gorbachev's classmates and now a history teacher at the school. It was absurd, but what did we know? Gorbachev was a Soviet best boy, with conventional ambitions and ideas. He was the leader of the school's Komsomol organization and became a candidate for membership in the Communist Party when he was only 18. He was no high school rebel. We were told that Stalin was doing everything perfectly, and we believed it all, Yuri Sarikov said. That was our level of understanding, and Mikhail Sergeyevich was no exception. None of us ever thought twice about it. After interviewing 15 or 20 people in town, the inevitable happened. The KGB caught up with me. Sredny, the school principal, took a phone call while I was in his office. "Da," he said grimly. And "da" 3 or 4 times more, all with the same dead tone of obedience. He hung up the receiver and, lifting his eyes to me, said, "I'm afraid I can't talk with you any more. Please wait here." Someone had obviously called the authorities, and I was soon summoned to the office of the Deputy Communist Party chief, the head chief being out of town on business. The deputy chief had a caveman brow and never smiled. When I told him I had heard no objections from the foreign ministry in Moscow to my coming to the countryside, the deputy chief did not betray the slightest emotion. "You will get in your car and proceed directly to Stavropol," he said. "What about Privilnoya?" I said. "I told the foreign ministry I'd go there too." "As you know, there is a quarantine."
"What quarantine?"
"You know very well. You were told."
"And how do you know that?"
The deputy chief blinked once, slowly, to indicate annoyance. I was not to be childish, he seemed to say. He had no time. He had an entire town to run into the ground before the year was out. Before leaving Krasnogvardaiskoye, I had asked a dozen people if Gorbachev had a girlfriend when he was in school. Everyone remembered the same name, Yulia Karagodina. Very pretty, if I remember. Played the snow girl in the play with Mikhail Sergeyevich. When I asked one local Communist Party official if she had Karagodina's number, she smiled girlishly, conspiratorially, and gave it to me. Yulia Karagodina, it turned out, had long ago moved to Moscow, where she was divorced, living with her mother, and teaching at a chemistry institute. When I called and asked to see her, Yulia, as she asked me to call her, was nervous, but quickly agreed. "Make sure you use Karagodina, my maiden name, and don't tell any other reporters my number. I knew this would happen sooner or later. I'll tell you everything, and that'll be it." A few days later, we met in a basement laboratory at her institute. Yulia was no longer beautiful, not even a match for the woman she faintly regarded as the victor, Raisa Maximovna. She was middle-aged, matronly, and sweet.
"Was it love?" I said.
"It was love, yes, it was, for both of us," she said. "I was attracted to him. He was magnetic. But I'd be upset if you thought that our relationship was like those that young people have now. It just wasn't that way. We were close friends, and we cared for each other and helped each other. It was, what would you say, a specific kind of friendship, not just a Komsomol thing. Young love, you might call it." We met for the first time in the September he arrived at school, and after a few months we grew closer. He once told me that he liked a blonde girl named Talia in Privilnoya, but that was more a child's affection. You know, it's funny, but whenever I watch him now on television leading the Supreme Soviet,
I think of Misha in school, playing the Grand Prince in Lermontov's masquerade, or heading the morning gym class, shouting into a big megaphone. Ready, class! Hup, 2, 3, 4! Hup, 2, 3, 4! He was fearless for someone that age. I remember him correcting teachers in history class. And once he was so angry at one teacher, he said, "Do you want to keep your teaching certificate?" He was the sort who felt he was right and could prove it to anyone, be it in the principal's office or at a Komsomol meeting. Yulia said she had grown up in a village much like Privolnoya, a few miles down the road. Her mother was a widowed schoolteacher, and so their circumstances were more modest than Gorbachev's. Yulia put her briefcase on the table and took out a huge sheaf of old photographs. In pictures of the young drama co-stars, Gorbachev was dark and regal in his homemade costume and fake mustache. Karagodina was wide-eyed, delicate, a bit far away. She looked like Lillian Gish in Broken Blossoms. As Yulia leafed through the pictures, slowly, like a child dealing cards, she said, "Once we were rehearsing Ostrovsky's play The Snow Girl, and there is a point when the Snow Girl, that was me, says, 'Dear Tsar, ask me 100 times if I love him, and I will answer 100 times that I do.' I said those lines in open rehearsal, with the principal sitting right there in the audience. Suddenly Gorbachev leaned over and whispered in my ear, 'Is it true?' My God, I was shaken. I could hardly go on with my monologue. Everyone was asking what had happened, and there was Gorbachev off to the side, smiling. Sometimes we spoke rather roughly to each other, but I was so dumbfounded I couldn't answer. The truth is, he was a very good actor. There was a time when he even talked with me and his friends Boris Gladskoy and Gennady Donskoy about trying for a theatrical institute. But I think he really always wanted to be a lawyer. We never really spoke about the future, except that we would go to Moscow and study there together. I'll tell you the truth. If we had been well-dressed, well-fed, and had everything like this generation, then maybe we would have talked about such things. But they were hard times, and we concentrated on our studies. I was very proud and poor. Gorbachev was better off. He was better dressed. During the war, my family had been evacuated from Krasnodar to the Stavropol region. Gorbachev's family were living in their own house on their own soil. They always had enough to eat. He once invited me to come meet his parents in Privolnoya. I said that I had been brought up in such a way that I could not do such a thing. I was too proud. I think I must have felt that his parents would feel that I was offering myself to them. I just imagined how they would look at me, a simple little girl. But Misha did visit my own home. At first we lived in a dugout hut, and then in a small house that we built ourselves. He had the bravery to tell my mother he liked me. But I kind of lied to my mother and said the two of us were just solving the problems of the Komsomol together. Spent the night on a little bed in the house, and I stayed with neighbors. He could be so cool and businesslike sometimes. Once, at a Komsomol meeting, in front of everyone at the local cinema house, he was angry with me for not finishing on time a little newspaper we put out. And, despite our friendship, he reprimanded me in front of everyone, saying that I'd failed, that I was late. He was shouting a bit, disciplining me. Then, afterward, it was as if nothing had happened. He said, "Let's go to the movies." I was at a loss. I couldn't understand why he did what he did, and I said so. He said, "My dear, one thing has nothing to do with another." That reminds me. Years later, I was living way outside of the city with my mother, and the commute was very long, and we had hardly any room. By then, Gorbachev was in the Central Committee. And so I wrote him a letter, asking him to help me. I wanted to get permission to move into the city center and get an apartment. I reminded him who I was, in case he had forgotten. I got the letter back soon after, and on it he had written simply that it wasn't his area, it wasn't his job, and that I should apply to the city authorities, not him. Just like that, so businesslike. Not one warm word. Deep in my heart I had hoped he would help me, but I suppose he wanted to avoid even the appearance of favoritism. In school it was all very innocent. We never said things like, "I love you," to each other. He would never say such things. And on the rare times he put his arm around my shoulder, as if to say, "Come, let's go to the movies or somewhere," I would kind of glance over at his hand. No, it wasn't like our young people today. I finished school first and went off first to Moscow. But I had no money and could not find any place to live. Remember, this was still a hard time. And so I returned to my village to work as a teacher. I've always thought that Gorbachev somehow thought I was weak for having come home. When he went off to the law faculty of Moscow State University, he wrote letters to me telling me how much he liked Moscow and the abundance of things and the fascinating people. There was never a sense in his letters that he felt any lack of confidence because he was a village boy. There were many letters, and later, when I was married, my husband was so jealous he burned them all. I suppose he didn't know Misha would be general secretary. I'm so sorry those letters are all gone. I'll tell you how it was. I think in the end I felt I was not really good enough for him, or we didn't really fit. He was too energetic, too serious, so organized. And he was smarter than I was. He was the center of attention. We drifted apart. Things were getting lost. But he did send me a letter at the end with his picture, and on it he wrote, "Dum spiro spero," Latin for, "While I am breathing, I am hoping." I suppose I didn't want to acknowledge that he was getting farther than me in life, so I said to myself, "Okay, Misha, live and write as you like, but as for me..." I accepted a job in the Soviet Far East. But even before I got there, on the road, so to say, I was married. The few people now who know that Misha and I were good friends sometimes ask me about Raisa Maximovna. I like Raisa. She plays her role very well. She's intelligent, and there's obviously a lot of love there between the two of them. She helps him greatly, that's clear enough. I'm not envious of her. I cannot say I am glad, just that my destiny is my destiny. I see things as a realist. When I do think back to those days, I see it as a pleasant island of time. Sometimes, when I watch him on television, I think to myself, "Poor Mikhail Sergeyevich. He is so tired, and he has the weight of the world on his shoulders. If he could only take out 10 minutes and just be Misha for a while." I think of how nice everything was back then. I see that moon in the country sky, and the little river, and everything was so lovely. Gorbachev came to Moscow in September 1950. At Moscow State University, where he would study law until 1955, he took a room with 6 others at the Strominka student dormitory. The crumbling, overcrowded dorm had once been a barracks for the soldiers of Peter the Great. Gorbachev had 1 jacket and 1 pair of decent pants to put in his closet. Gorbachev was a villager, and you might have expected him to seem worse off than the city boys. But we were all poor then, and our new surroundings were no better, said Rudolf Kolchanov, an editor at the labor newspaper Trud, who roomed with Gorbachev for 3 years. Zdenek Mlinar, a Czech communist and another of Gorbachev's college friends, arrived at the same time in Moscow as an exchange student from Prague, and recalled a Moscow of poverty and backwardness, a huge village of wooden cottages where people had barely enough to eat, where most families lived in one room and instead of flush toilets there was only an opening leading directly to a drainpipe. In his memoir of the Prague Spring, Mlinar wrote that in Moscow at the time, what you didn't hold on to tightly would be stolen from you in a crowd. Drunks lay unconscious in the streets, and could be dead for all the passers-by knew or cared. Dressed in his baggy hayseed clothes, Gorbachev tried doggedly to catch up with students who had gone to superior schools in the city. He often returned from the library at 1 or 2 in the morning, and then stayed up another couple of hours talking with his roommates. Mlinar, Gorbachev, Kolchanov, and 6 war veterans would lock the door, turn a portrait of Stalin to the wall, revealing on the back an amateur portrait of a Tsarist-era courtesan, and drink and talk the night away. Yes, it could be grim and wild even, Kolchanov said. But Gorbachev seemed to avoid drinking too much. He was fastidious that way. That dorm room may have been the greatest classroom for all of us. We talked about everything from girls to more serious things. The latest exhibition, or the latest artistic awards or historical event. Of course, one subject that was never mentioned was Stalin himself. That was too risky, even with the door closed. The law class was dominated by some older vets and younger men, like Gorbachev, who had won academic medals in high schools. Unlike the politics or history departments, the law departments provided their students, by the standards of the time, with a relatively wide reading list. Along with the standard diet of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, students read many of the essential works of Western thought. Roman law, Locke's treatises on government, Rousseau's social contract, and even the U.S. Constitution. But those texts served mainly as relics of bourgeois liberalism, and the core readings, the Holy Writ, were Stalinist textbooks. Gorbachev, who as General Secretary would campaign for a law-based state, was steeped in the theory of its opposite, Stalinism. The theme of political crimes was touched upon only in very brief and general terms, according to Mlinar. There was nothing complex about it, as long as you accepted the fundamental principle that political activity upsetting to the government was comparable to any other form of criminal activity. Dissidence among the students was a crime. Dozens of students were arrested for ideological missteps and sent to labor camps. Mlinar, who returned to Czechoslovakia and eventually helped lead Alexander Dubček's ill-fated Prague Spring reforms, now lives in Vienna. Some biographers have found a pleasant irony in what they see as Mlinar's influence on the man who would become the most powerful reformer in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. But Kolchanov said that the influence is overrated. Gorbachev was intellectually curious, he was tolerant, but there were no signs of radicalism. You can't make those leaps. Remember, Stalinism was something deep inside us. We were only lucky that we were young enough and flexible enough to change later on. But there was in Gorbachev and some of his friends a tendency toward independence, toward questioning authority, that was surprising, considering the times. Once, in 1952, as a professor teaching Marxism and issues of language droned on, he was reading straight from the works of Stalin, Gorbachev rose from his chair and said, "Respected professor, we can read for ourselves. What is your interpretation of the reading, and why don't we discuss it?" Gorbachev was summoned to the dean's office, but he was not punished. Probably his position in the Komsomol helped him avoid a suspension.
But at the same time, Gorbachev was a leader of the law department's Komsomol group, and in this position he took no risks. Two émigrés now living in the West, who were in Gorbachev's class, remembered him as a hardliner in the Komsomol, who made speeches scolding the shortcomings and improprieties of fellow party members. Writing in the émigré journal, Posef, Friedrich Neznansky recalled hearing the steely voice of the Komsomol secretary of the law department, Gorbachev, demanding expulsion from the Komsomol for the slightest offense, from telling inappropriate political jokes to trying to avoid being sent to a collective farm. Midway through his five-year course, Gorbachev met Raisa Titorenko, a philosophy student from Siberia. A few of Gorbachev's friends were taking a ballroom dancing class, and one day Gorbachev and Kolchanov dropped by with the expressed purpose of mocking their buddies. "We were ready to say, 'You call yourselves real men, and look at all this,' Kolchanov said. But then one of our friends in the class, Volodya Kuzmin, introduced Mikhail Sergeyevich to his dance partner. It was Raisa Maximovna. I think for Gorbachev it was love at first sight. Just like in the movies. She was just so striking. And, as I think he discovered later on, she was extremely smart. Raisa, for her part, liked Gorbachev, according to Molinar, for his lack of vulgarity. The marriage may have been the crucial personal event of Gorbachev's youth, but the signal political event for nearly everyone of his generation came in March 1953, the death of Joseph Stalin. In the years to come, Khrushchev would set free hundreds of thousands of prisoners and begin to tell the truth about Stalin. Although Gorbachev would choose the path of the party apparatchik, scaling his way up through the hierarchy, flattering Brezhnev and his superiors, he would be one of thousands who would be changed by the 20th Party Congress in 1956, when Khrushchev gave his secret speech denouncing Stalin. Through a long process of personal and historical change, Gorbachev would recognize the need to transform the country and its relationship to the world. "Really, we have no alternative," he would say, decades later. But at the moment Stalin died, there was for Gorbachev and his friends only stunning confusion. "There are a lot of things you could say about Mikhail in the old days that you could say now," Rudolf Kolchanov said. "He was hard-working, a good listener, tolerant, decent. But he was also much like the rest of us. In fact, he was not the most impressive student in our class by any means. And he believed what he was taught about Stalin. It's not as if he were always a great reformer and world leader just waiting to happen. Most of us were out all night in the freezing cold trying to see Stalin's body at the Hall of Columns. When we all got back to the room in the early hours of the morning, we were sitting on our beds. We tried to talk, but mostly we were just silent, thinking. Some were crying, though I remember that I wasn't, and neither was Mikhail Sergeyevich. We were so accustomed to life under Stalin. We might find it strange and terrible now, but that was how it was. And then someone spoke the question that everyone had on his mind. What are we going to do now?" Chapter 11. The Double Thinkers. A very popular error, having the courage of one's convictions. Rather, it is a matter of having the courage for an attack on one's own convictions. Friedrich Nietzsche, Notebooks. On a winter's night in 1986, two electricians and their KGB escort installed a special telephone in the apartment of Andrei Sakharov. For 6 years, Sakharov and his wife, Yelena Bonner, had been living in the industrial city of Gorky under government edict, and the phone seemed at first just another Orwellian moment in the day of exiles. Maybe the Soviet press would call for an interview, Sakharov thought. Two magazines had already put in requests. Turning the moral equations in his mind, Sakharov arrived at a finely calibrated stand of principle. He would refuse all interview requests until there was no longer a noose around my neck. The KGB agent merely turned to Sakharov and said, "You will get a call around 10 tomorrow morning." The next day the phone rang. A woman's voice said, "Mikhail Sergeyevich will speak to you." Now Gorbachev was on the line, telling Sakharov that he and Bonner could return home to Moscow. "You have an apartment there," Gorbachev said without a word of apology or regret. "Go back to your patriotic work." Sakharov said a brief word of thanks, then wasted no time in going back to his patriotic work. He told Gorbachev that for the sake of trust, for peace, and for you and your program, the Kremlin was obliged to release the political prisoners included on a long list he had mailed to the leadership from Gorky. The Soviet leader said he did not quite agree that all the prisoners Sakharov was speaking for had been tried illegally. Then the two men said their awkward goodbyes. 1 week later, Sakharov arrived by overnight train at Moscow's Yaroslavl station, an event of such moral and political importance that it evoked another homecoming decades earlier, that of Lenin at the Finland station. But no one could have predicted what was ahead for Sakharov in the 3 years left to him. Exile had worn him down. KGB threats, a painful hunger strike, forced feedings, random attacks, thefts of his diaries and manuscripts, all of it had taken a toll on his health. Now, as he answered questions into the swarm of tape recorders and television lights, his voice was mumbly, hesitant at times. He walked with a stoop and had to catch his breath every few steps on flights of stairs. Bonner said at the time that Sakharov would limit his activities. He would read up on developments in cosmology and work on specific human rights cases. That seemed like more than enough. A few days after his return to Moscow, Sakharov was sitting at the kitchen table of his close friend, the human rights activist Larisa Bogoras. Another of the guests, the historian Mikhail Gefter, turned to Sakharov and said, "How are you feeling, Andrei Dmitrievich?" Sakharov said sadly, "It is difficult to live now. People write me, they visit, and they are all hoping that I will be able to help somehow. But I am powerless." For months, Sakharov mulled over his role, tried to find his political voice. Some younger dissidents were impatient with Sakharov's hesitation, and what they saw as his naive, uncritical support of Gorbachev. Those young dissidents probably should have known better, but the rest of the country knew Sakharov hardly at all. They could not have known what sort of man he was. Until Sakharov returned from exile, most people knew nothing more about him than the slanders they had read for years in the press. Even intellectuals with some connection to the human rights movement knew little about him. "We knew he was out there, but for years Sakharov was almost like a myth," said Lev Timofeyev, one of the political prisoners freed shortly after Sakharov's return from Gorky. But when Sakharov did return home, his gift for judgment became an open secret and a public trust. Many ordinary people who had been instructed to despise Sakharov came to love and trust him. Through him they saw the hollowness of the old propaganda and the system itself. There was a sense of the uncanny about Sakharov. In 1988, at a discussion sponsored by and published in Ogonyok magazine, a group of Soviet and American intellectuals went around the table trading opinions on the myriad issues of perestroika. For nearly an hour, Sakharov seemed half asleep. But when it came his turn,
He found all the inherent faults in the latest wave of political reforms. He zeroed in especially on the unhealthy way Gorbachev continued to control both the government and the Communist Party. No one had ever said that before. And yet, as we all left the room, Sakharov's brief exposition seemed like sense itself. For anyone living in Moscow in those years, Saturday mornings were a time to listen to this voice. Sakharov was everywhere. He inevitably became either the chairman or the spiritual leader of all the key groups to the left of Gorbachev. First Moscow Tribune, then Memorial, and later the interregional group of radical deputies in the parliament. Nearly every Saturday morning, Sakharov would sit in some dim auditorium, usually the House of Scholars on Kropotkinskaya Street, or the Filmmakers' Union near the Peking Hotel. And for half an eternity he would doze, his great dome of a head nodding off as the speeches went on. When it was his turn at last, Sakharov would take the lectern, and in a few minutes of very formal, incisive Russian, he would make the point that most needed making, invariably pushing public thinking ever closer to the creation of a civil society. With the authority of his life and the clarity of his thinking, Sakharov became a one-man loyal opposition, a moral genius who was now, at last, able to speak directly to the people. Sakharov was the only one among us who made no compromises, said Tatyana Zaslavskaya, a leading sociologist whose views helped shape the early reforms. For us he was a figure of the inner spirit. Just the bare facts of his life, the way he suffered for all of us, gave him authority that no one else had. Without him, we could not begin to rebuild our society or ourselves. Gorbachev may not have understood it quite that way when he let Sakharov come home, but he would understand it eventually. What made Sakharov unique was not his suffering alone. Others had suffered much more. And what made him unique was not his ideas. He shared his ideas with men and women who were dissidents even before he was. Larisa Bogoras, Pyotr Yakir, Pavel Litvinov, Solzhenitsyn, and, for that matter, the first opponents of Russian totalitarianism, Alexander Herzen, Nikolai Berdyaev, Vladimir Soloviev. My father's ideas were not original, Sakharov's son Ephraim told me. His ideas of morality and liberty had all been said before. It was his fate to bring received wisdom to a place where it did not yet exist. The story of the perestroika years, the years between the rise of Gorbachev and the collapse of the Soviet state, was, to a great extent, the story of change inside the hearts and minds of individuals. Sakharov's life and thought prefigured that change in such a dramatic way that I would not hesitate to call him a saint. He was the dominant moral example of his time and place. Sakharov was a scientist whose metaphors and sense of truth were rooted in an understanding of cosmology, the magic spectacle of a thermonuclear explosion, the calculus of the Big Bang. His unerring sense of rightness, like that of scientist moralists from Galileo to Oppenheimer, was steeped in his understanding of the scientific problems of light and time, his first-hand appreciation of both the laws of the universe and man's tragic tendency to turn progress into catastrophe. He held in mind, it seemed, a picture, even a music, of eternity. Sakharov once turned to his wife and said, "Do you know what I love most of all in life?" Later, Bonner would confide to a friend, "I expected he would say something about a poem or a sonata, or even about me." Instead, Sakharov said, "The thing I love most in life is radio background emanation." The barely discernible reflection of unknown cosmic processes that ended billions of years ago. Sakharov was a man inclined toward the purities of theoretical physics,
but who became the conscience of the Soviet Union. A political actor in spite of himself. His physics and his politics grew out of the same mind, the same sense of wholeness and responsibility. Other civilizations, perhaps more successful ones, may exist an infinite number of times on the preceding and following pages of the Book of the Universe, Sakharov wrote in his Nobel Prize lecture. Yet we should not minimize our sacred endeavors in the world where, like faint glimmers in the dark, we have emerged for a moment from the nothingness of unconsciousness into material existence. We must make good the demands of reason and create a life worthy of ourselves and of the goals we only dimly perceive. For almost every young man and woman who would one day join the circle of Communist Party liberals around Gorbachev, the death of Stalin was the pivotal event of moral and intellectual life. The same was true for Sakharov. Like Gorbachev, Sakharov knew well the horrors of the age. When he was a boy, his Aunt Zhenya received news of her husband's death in the camps when one of her letters was returned, addressee relocated to the cemetery. Later, one of Sakharov's friends died in the gulag, the authorities announced, owing to a chilling of the epidermal integument. And yet, Sakharov's response to the death of Stalin was utterly typical. He heard the news while he was working on the Soviet bomb project and wrote home to his first wife, Klavdia. I am under the influence of a great man's death. I am thinking of his humanity. Even in his memoirs, written 3 decades later, Sakharov could not pretend to understand his own reaction. I can't fully explain it. After all, I knew quite enough about the horrible crimes that had been committed, the arrests of innocent people, the torture, the deliberate starvations, and all the violence, to pass judgment on those responsible. But I hadn't put the whole picture together, and in any case, there was still a lot I didn't know. Somewhere in the back of my mind, the idea existed, instilled by propaganda, that suffering is inevitable during great historic upheavals. When you chop wood, the chips fly. But above all, I felt myself committed to the goal which I assumed was Stalin's as well, after a devastating war to make the country strong enough to ensure peace. Precisely because I had invested so much of myself in that cause and accomplished so much, I needed, as anyone might in my circumstances, to create an illusory world to justify myself. Sakharov's sense of patriotic urgency after the American attack on Hiroshima, and also the sheer seduction of the scientific world involved, left him no choice, he once said, but to move to a desolate weapons research center in Kazakhstan, known only as the Installation, the Soviet Los Alamos. Even though he was immersed in what he called the superb physics of nuclear weaponry, the sustenance of life on Earth, but also the potential instrument of its destruction, were taking shape at my very desk, Sakharov still saw the gulag through the fence. The Installation, where Sakharov lived for 18 years, was near a slave labor camp, and every morning he watched long lines of prisoners trudge to and fro, guard dogs at their heels. Nevertheless, there was a determined innocence about Sakharov in those first years at the Installation. The prisoners and the guard dogs were a background that could be overlooked. But 5 months after Stalin's death, Sakharov began a personal and political conversion ignited by nothing less than the explosion of the first Soviet thermonuclear bomb. On August 12, 1953, 20 miles from Ground Zero, he watched the explosion, his eyes protected by dark goggles. The test was a success, and in his memoirs, Sakharov describes the vision only in its incandescence, without a trace of regret. We saw a flash, and then a swiftly expanding white ball lit up the whole horizon. I tore off my goggles, and though I was partially blinded by the glare, I could see a stupendous cloud trailing streamers of purple dust. The government awarded Sakharov and his partner, Igor Tam, 500,000 rubles each, dachas in the countryside outside Moscow, and the title of Hero of Socialist Labor. Marshal Kliment Voroshilov spoke for the state at the award ceremony in the Kremlin. "I have been told that Sakharov's work was especially outstanding," he said. "Let me kiss you." In the months to come, Sakharov grew more and more concerned about the effects of nuclear fallout. Secretly, he was beginning to make calculations, trying to figure out how many innocent people would likely be hurt by every nuclear test. Roald Sagdeyev, the former head of the Soviet space program, visited Sakharov at the installation after the test and noticed how this young, distant god of physics drew little offhand doodles of airplanes dropping bombs as he talked. "Those were the first real doubts," Sagdeyev told me. The accidental deaths of a young girl and a soldier at the test site also startled Sakharov. Then, after another successful test in 1955, Sakharov's sense of complicity in these few accidents began to torture him. At a banquet after the test, Sakharov gave the first toast and said, "May all our devices explode as successfully as today's, but always over test sites and never over cities." The table fell silent, Sakharov recalled, as if I had said something indecent. Marshal Mitrofan Nedelin, the ranking military man at the banquet, rose to give a counter toast, the rebuke. "Let me tell a parable," he said. "An old man wearing only a shirt was praying before an icon. 'Guide me, harden me, guide me, harden me.' His wife, who was lying in bed, said, 'Just pray to be hard, old man. I can guide it in myself. Let's drink to getting hard.'" Sakharov turned pale. He understood well that Nedelin's joke was a parable. He wanted to squelch my pacifist sentiment, and to put me and anyone who might share these ideas in my place, Sakharov wrote. "The ideas and emotions kindled at that moment have not diminished to this day, and they completely altered my thinking." Finally, Sakharov understood. His moral protests were nothing to the men of the Communist Party. The party was way beyond the control even of a hero of socialist labor. So, gradually, Sakharov became a dissident, and the ideas of his dissidence, which crystallized in his 1968 manifesto, Reflections on Progress, Peaceful Coexistence, and Intellectual Freedom, anticipated the ideas of perestroika. But while Sakharov was the moral leader of the era, he was not a man of raw political power. There may have been no Gorbachev without Sakharov, no perestroika without the efforts of the dissidents to keep the idea of truth alive in a dead time, but there were other figures, less easy to love, more ambiguous, who had the political power to make something out of ideas. Gorbachev and the most influential people around him were contradictory men, politicians, academics, and journalists whose lives were filled with doubt, small victories, and sorry compromises. They had done things of which they were ashamed, or should have been. For the sake of ambition, they told themselves lies and half-truths. They served brutal masters and tried not to care too much. There was Vitali Korotich, the crusading editor of Ogonyok, who had once been only too glad to write a scurrilous book about America called The Face of Hatred. There was the poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko, preternaturally vain, slippery, periodically brave. And there were the Gorbachev advisers who had worked in the Central Committee staff under Yuri Andropov and still remembered it as an oasis of free thinking. The Americanist Georgi Arbatov, the policy advisers Anatoly Chernayev, Georgi Shaknazarov, and Oleg Bogomolov, the journalists Alexander Bovin and Fyodor Burlatsky. These were the Shesti Desyatniki, those who came of age during the thaw under Khrushchev, and grew disillusioned when Soviet tanks crushed the Prague Spring in 1968. They were the generation that woke to the horror of the Stalin era after Khrushchev's secret speech of 1956 denouncing the personality cult. They harbored the dream of a humane socialism in Russia. They did not dare take the risks of full-blown dissidents, as Sakharov had, but they found a measure of independence and sanity in their work. There were scholars like Abel Aganbegyan and Tatyana Zaslavskaya, who fled the oppressive scrutiny of Moscow for the relative academic freedom of Novosibirsk. There were journalists like Yegor Yakovlev and Yuri Karyakin, who fled Pravda for Prague, and wrote for the slightly liberal magazine Problems of Peace and Socialism. The Shesti Desyatniki, especially those from Moscow and Leningrad, were like an enormous floating club in which everyone had a nodding acquaintance with everyone else. They scrutinized each other's compromises and drew fine distinctions that would appear to be nonsense to anyone outside. The gossip in this crowd was as thick as it is in official Washington or the studios of Hollywood. Whether they worked in academia, for the press, or inside the Central Committee, it was all the same. Every day they were faced with questions of what to say, whom to protect, when to withdraw. They thought one thing and said another, and sometimes, after speaking lies long enough, they believed them and were beyond redeeming. Gorbachev, me, all of us, we were double thinkers. We had to balance truth and propaganda in our minds all the time, said Shakhnazarov, an elfin intellectual who was at Gorbachev's side from start to finish. It is not something I'm particularly proud of, but that is the way we lived. It was the choice between dissidence and surrender. Westerners were often fast to judge these people. They came from countries where liberty was almost a given, and still they mocked men and women in the Soviet Union who looked foolish in the act of trying to save both their families and their souls. The system made beasts of them, and it was a sorry sight. When the atmosphere of fear began to fade under Gorbachev, there were those who grabbed the public stage shamelessly, as if all that they had done in the past was of no matter. Some had trimmed their ideological sails for so many years that it was hard to take them seriously. They were indecent. But there were also quite a few who not only relished their new power, they understood their contradictions. They were complicated men and women who had done the best they could and knew their best was far from exemplary. Len Vyacheslavovich Karpinsky, a columnist and later editor-in-chief of Moscow News, was among the most likable because his case was one of the most complicated and tragic. Len Karpinsky's parents were old Bolsheviks. He was named in honor of his father's mentor and friend, Lenin. The name Len was pretty common then, and so was Ninel, Lenin backward, or Vladilin for Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, Karpinsky said. I'm just glad I didn't get a name like Electrifikatsia or some others my friends got stuck with. Karpinsky's father, Vyacheslav Karpinsky, belonged to a generation of revolutionary romantics, the fin de siècle communists. He joined the Communist Party in 1898, and in 1903, after his activities as a political organizer got him into trouble with the police in the Ukrainian city of Kharkov, he went into exile. In Switzerland, he was Lenin's aide and copy editor. In Moscow, after the revolution, he helped Lenin assemble his personal archives from exile and held various posts at Pravda and the Central Committee's Department of Propaganda. He received three orders of Lenin and in 1962 became the first journalist ever named a hero of socialist labor. For the Karpinsky family, a life in revolution provided an elevated sort of existence. From 1932 to 1952, they lived in the house on the embankment with the Kremlin elite,
generals, Central Committee members, agents of the secret police. There were billiard halls, swimming pools, and, for the children, special school number 19. When Len Karpinski was a boy, he was even friendly with a couple of Stalin's nephews. At a birthday party once, the playing stopped as the runty, pockmarked man with the withered left arm, the Mountain Eagle, the friend of all children, stood in the doorway. "Children," one of the adults announced, "Yosef Vissarionovich is here." Stalin waved and smiled. The children all waited in silence until he left, and then resumed their games. That was in 1935. In the coming years, Len watched dumbstruck as one acquaintance after another in the building lost parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and friends to the great furnace of Stalin's purges. Nearly every night, secret police vans would arrive and there would be arrests. An admiral, a lecturer on Marxism-Leninism, the sisters of a spy in a foreign embassy. There was a knock, and then they disappeared, Len said. It had been the world of Yuri Trifonov's novella, The House on the Embankment. A world where a life went on that was utterly different from the life of ordinary people. Now it was a world where the most devoted revolutionaries, the most obsequious ministers, suddenly found themselves declared plotters and infiltrators and enemies of the people. Karpinski's family was, by the standards of the building, not hard hit. One of his aunts and her two brothers were sent off to the camps. To this day, Karpinski does not quite understand why his father, the very sort of Lenin loyalist who so threatened Stalin, was never arrested and executed. "The only reason he can think of now," he said, "is that by 1937 or 1938, his father was semi-retired and out of politics." From the moment that the leadership installed Karpinski's old friend Yegor Yakovlev as editor-in-chief, Moscow News became the paper of the thaw generation, subtly breaking taboos formed over 70 years. From time to time I visited Karpinski at the Moscow News office on Pushkin Square, and he always seemed to me an honest man, if a limited writer. A representative figure whose life had been, as he put it to me, the inner conflict between the ambition to be a boss in the Communist Party and the almost involuntary development of a conscience. His appearance, waxen and drawn, spoke of that struggle. He looked exhausted at every minute of the day. His face was long, lined, and worn. The fingers of his right hand were yellowed up to the first knuckle from tobacco. More often than not, when I called and asked how he was, he would say dryly, "My health is awful. I'm spending the week in a sanatorium. I may die." Karpinski was so unassuming, so ironic about his own failures and hesitations, that it was hard to believe he was once, in the culture of Soviet politics, as ambitious as any flaxen-haired kid who takes a job as a Senate intern and starts talking about the day I run for office. He believed deeply in communism and in himself, in his entitlement to success. After entering Moscow State University in 1947, he began working as a propaganda man at factories and construction sites during the days before the party's single-candidate elections. "My assignment was to make the workers get up at 6 a.m. and go to the polls," he told me. There was a competition among the propaganda men over whose group would be the first to finish voting. The limit was midday, by which time the whole Soviet people was supposed to have voted. That was a decision of the party. We 18-year-olds were supposed to conduct propaganda among the voters, and the only tool was the promise to improve their housing conditions. They lived in horrible slums, railway cars with no toilets, no heat. I loved the work, thought it was a great service, and yes, a stepping stone. At the university,
Yuri Levada, who is now a well-known sociologist, wrote an article about me called The Careerist. And it was true. I did it all with the idea of getting to the top. That was what it was all about, to be one of the bosses. But having said that, I have to say a few words in self-defense. Society, during the Stalin era, left open no real opportunities for self-realization or self-expression except within this perverted system of the Communist Party. The system destroyed all the other channels, the artist's canvas, the farmer's land. All that was left was the gigantic, hierarchic system of the party, wide at the base and growing narrower as one climbed to the top. You had to have a party membership just for admission. That was the only opportunity. When you are engaged in that work, you forget about the social and political implications and just do it. Gradually, this sort of life bifurcates your mentality, your intellect. You can begin to understand that life is life, and it's better to do something good for thy neighbor than to climb upward stepping on their bones. But it all depends on moral principles. I suppose my first doubts came when I went to Moscow State University in 1948. A Jewish friend of mine named Karl Kantor was attacked at the university's party committee at the start of Stalin's anti-Jewish campaign. That was just the start of a long transformation. After graduation, I was sent to the city of Gorky for Komsomol work. It was in 1952, and Stalin had one more year to live. I got to know the working class and the peasants there. I saw the utter degradation, the ruin. I saw Soviet society as it had really emerged. This intellectual conscience that I talk about began to emerge. Some people still think, erroneously, that the life of the apparatchik breeds only conformists and subjects loyal to the regime. Actually, the regime splits people into two opposing factions. Those who believe they can make it only through conformism and time-serving, and those who, thanks to a different structure of mind, dare to question the surrounding reality. So, when Stalin died, I realized perfectly well what he had been all about. Still, I went to the funeral in Moscow out of curiosity. I felt like one of those prisoners in the camps who threw his hat in the air and cried, "The man-eater has finally kicked the bucket." My father's reaction to Stalin's death was interesting. By then he was retired, working for the Central Committee only as a consultant. He sat there in his office, typing on an old Underwood, which he had brought from the offices he had in Switzerland with Lenin. He called me into his study and said, "Son, Comrade Stalin has passed away, and having been an epigone of Lenin, he created all the necessary conditions for our cause to triumph." It was so strange. My father had never talked so formally before to me in his life. I think he talked that way because his generation had always carried a burden to promote at all times the party line, and he felt it was his duty to pass that down to his children. But in a way, this was a man, 80 years old, who had conceived of his idea of the party before the revolution and while living in exile. He had to convince not me, but himself. He was talking to himself. When Karpinsky returned from Gorky to Moscow for good in 1959, the thaw was in full swing. Novy Mir, Alexander Tvardovsky's monthly journal of literature and opinion, was publishing texts critical of the old regime. Khrushchev himself read a manuscript copy of Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich and sanctioned its publication in Novy Mir. Karpinsky's friends Yevgeny Yevtushenko and Andrei Voznesensky were winning a following with their lyrics and public performances. In various pockets of the Central Committee apparatus, young apparatchiks wrote proposals and outlines of economic and political reform, though all within certain boundaries of ideology and language. For his part, Karpinsky worked as head of the Komsomol's Department of Propaganda and Agitation, and as the editor of Molodoy Kommunist,
young communist. Then, in 1962, he joined the Empyrean of the adult communist world. He was promoted to Pravda's editorial board, heading the Department of Marxism-Leninism. He had made it. Once I was back in Moscow from Gorky, my critical approach weakened somewhat, Karpinsky said. I was part of the elite again, and not merely as my father's son, but as a real member. I was part of the top nomenklatura, and the nomenklatura is another planet. It's Mars. It's not simply a matter of good cars or apartments. It's the continuous satisfaction of your own whims, the way an army of bootlickers allows you to work painlessly for hours. All the little apparatchiks are ready to do everything for you. Your every wish is fulfilled. You can go to the theater on a whim. You can fly to Japan from your hunting lodge. It's a life in which everything flows easily. No, you don't own a yacht or spend your vacations on the Côte d'Azur, but you are at the Black Sea, and that really is something. The issue is your relative well-being. You are like a king. Just point your finger and it is done. Karpinsky's potential as a man of the Communist Party elite was unlimited. It is conceivable that he could have won election to the Politburo one day. He was a Soviet Ivy Leaguer, bright, ambitious, a legacy. One afternoon at a Kremlin ceremony, two of Khrushchev's most powerful partners in the leadership, Mikhail Suslov and Boris Ponomarev, complimented Karpinsky as their golden boy, their comer. One of them said Karpinsky was like a son of the regiment to them, and they saw for him a great future in the ideological department of the Communist Party. "We are pinning our hopes on you," Suslov said. Working in that rarefied atmosphere, Karpinsky got to know nearly every figure who would make a difference, one way or another, during Perestroika. He was friendly with Yegor Yakovlev, the Lenin biographer who became the editor of Moscow News. Yuri Karyakin, a Dostoevsky scholar who was among the leading radical deputies in the Congress of People's Deputies. Alexander Bovin, the gargantuan journalist at Izvestia, who promoted the new thinking in foreign policy. The reform-minded economists Gavriil Popov and Nikolai Shmelyov, and the sociologist Yevgeny Ambartsumov. Otto Latsis, the son of an old Bolshevik and an editor at Communist. Gennady Yanayev and Boris Pugo, who helped lead the August coup. And even the leading triumvirate of reform, Edvard Shevardnadze, Alexander Yakovlev, and Gorbachev himself. I first met Gorbachev in the 60s when I was working at Pravda, and he was in Stavropol working in the Komsomol organization there, Karpinsky said. He was not very well known at the time, but I must tell you that Gorbachev was saying the same things then that he did at the beginning of Perestroika. He was in Moscow on some business trip or another. I forget what it was all about. But we met for a couple of hours, and I was impressed. He talked about the outrage of paying combine operators by the mileage and not their output. In a nutshell, he spoke about the absurd system of incentives, or lack of them, in the economy. He was excitable, but somehow very rational. And for the first 2 or 3 years of Perestroika, Gorbachev was the same sort of innovator he was when he was young. The innovative projects were always limited, within certain boundaries, and that, of course, was telling later on. Well, I understand him. Like all of us, Gorbachev had to have a dual nature. It was in his mind and soul. He knew well that the idea of reward for work well done was considered out of the ordinary, but not quite heretical. You could experiment with something limited like that. But we were not allowed to make any political or philosophical conclusions that the system itself was a failure. In your mind, you avoided such conclusions. You were simply incapable of thinking that way. To think that way was not only career suicide, it was a form of despair. And so, like the rest of us, Gorbachev hedged, outwardly and within himself. Karpinski and his friends were at first not greatly upset with Brezhnev and Suslov's overthrow of Khrushchev in 1964. When Karpinski heard the news, he and Yegor Yakovlev celebrated over a bottle of cognac. Khrushchev had long since tightened restrictions on the press and the arts, and he had become prone to unpredictable decisions. A manic voluntarism, as the party language had it. It was only years later, when Khrushchev was a sad old man living in the exile of his dacha, that Karpinski called him to wish him well on his birthday. Karpinski said he was calling on behalf of the children of the 20th Party Congress, and that Khrushchev should know that one day history would make clear to everyone the importance of that session, in 1956, at which he leveled his first attacks against Stalin's cult of personality. "I have always believed this, and I am very pleased that you and your relatively young generation understand the essence of the 20th Congress and the policies I initiated," Khrushchev replied. "I am so happy to hear from you in my twilight years." It did not take Karpinski, or anyone else, long to realize that Brezhnev had no intention of instituting reforms. Just the opposite. A neo-Stalinist movement was in the works. One night at dinner with Yevtushenko and Otto Latsis, Karpinski began to pronounce aloud what was happening to his generation, to its way of thinking. "Our idea was this. When one has an education in philosophy and a certain intellectual background, one begins to understand the inner properties of reality, something I termed intellectual conscience. It's not a natural inborn conscience, yet a conscience that stems from a kind of thinking that links you with a moral attitude to reality. If you understand that everything in this society is soaked in blood, that society itself is heading toward collapse, that it is all an anti-human system, if you understand this instinctively and intellectually, then your conscience cannot remain neutral. Look, I never really took any risks, and didn't want to. I was sort of compelled to take the steps I did by my conscience. And once compelled to take those steps, I could never foresee the bad consequences. Every time I thought I'd get away with it. And every time I didn't." Karpinski made his first real